Hello and welcome to another episode of the Future of Real Estate podcast. I'm Damien Wild, Editor-in-Chief of EG. Last month's EG Awards were a blast and a real signal that EG and this industry is serious about thinking differently. Celebratory yes, stuffy no, and focus less on past performance and more on readiness for the future. There were new categories reflecting this shift and none more significant than our new Social Impact Award. We were blown away by the number of organisations of all shapes and sizes who entered, and we were impressed by so many of them, especially Capital & Centric, whose Regeneration Brainery is a mightily impressive initiative. I caught up with co-founder Tim Heatley ahead of the awards, and rest assured I didn't tell him he had won. Here he explains what the Brainery is all about and why social impact is embedded in everything that Capital & Centric does. But first I began by asking him about the state of the market in the Northwest where the business is based. So Tim, welcome to the EG studio.
Thank you.
How's the market? We continue to live in these less uncertain times. I just wonder how it's impacting on Capital & Centric.
Well, I think it's interesting time. It's difficult to kind of point your finger to any one change or any one kind of signal as to how the market's performing in the Northwest, which is kind of predominantly where we are and where our developments are. And so I kind of feel as though, if anything, that kind of that there's been a bit of, over time, there's been a curbing of enthusiasm for excessive growth and funding and investment. And I hope that as things become clearer politically and economically, that'll rebound quite quickly, and at the same time, not too much. You know, I don't want it to overheat too quickly. So,
bring a bit of sobriety back, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it. In some ways, I think it's been useful, the uncertainty, because if anything, the city centre of Manchester, for example, arguably could have overheated from a residential perspective. And so, what's been refreshing to see this time, which was different to the uncertainty that occurred back in 08 and 09, to put it mildly, is that there's been kind of less starts on sites, and there's been a bit more of an awareness and consciousness as to where the market is, and therefore we've seen just a little bit of slowing down rather than gung-ho cracking ahead, which inevitably switched to oversupply very quickly all those years ago now. So I think in some ways it's been positive.
Okay, and is there one Northwest market, or does it differ?
You know, it differs massively. It does. That there are
willfully naive question.
Yeah. So it differs massively between cities. You know, it's and also there are many cities, certainly in the north of England, and actually in the West Midlands and the Northwest, where despite you know they are you know despite the boom and despite how things have gone, they still struggle to get to get things viable, and so often they're the last cities, if you like, which are the satellite towns and cities around the major cities of, say, Leeds, Manchester, Liverpool. They're the last to benefit from the boom, but the first to kind of to feel the burden of a cooling economy. Depending upon how you move around the Northwest, you don't have to go far to go from prosperity to kind of disadvantage, and so it's fascinating, really.
No, of course. I was thinking more about those core cities, actually. Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds.
Yeah, again, there's a huge... You can just walk around them and see and feel the difference in terms of, it might be the number of suits that you see. Some feel more cosmopolitan than others. For example, Leeds at the minute is quite a way behind in terms of residential growth and development than Manchester. Liverpool's come off a really low base in terms of residential development, but actually it's flying along now. It's got the population growth in Liverpool far outstrips that of Manchester, but because it's coming off a low base. So it's surprising how different each of the big cities in the north of England are, really.
And in terms of the approach that Capital & Centric takes, you know, if you walk out of Piccadilly Station in Manchester, you come up against one of your hoardings very quickly. You've got the Littlewoods project up in Liverpool, of course. And wrapped around that is some very interesting work that you're doing with the Regeneration Brainery and with the mayor in Manchester as well. Perhaps you could describe those.
Yeah, so we have, we say to people, if you want to see what we do, if you pop to Manchester as an example, you can see we're investing about £500 million within a half an hour's walk. it's exciting times, and we are of course in other cities beyond Manchester and Liverpool now, and I think that's us taking our approach to and our kind of philosophy around development to other cities to see if we can apply some of that thinking, and I suppose and some of that actually is trying to find ways of creating prosperity and growth in challenging locations, and as a result of that, and as a result of us kind of being kind of very much on this mantra about, look, it's not about property, it's about people. Understanding people is the way to have a successful property company and to grow quickly. And I suppose because of that, we need to practice what we preach as well. And that got us involved in looking more holistically at how we can help a city culturally and perhaps financially, and also to let other sectors have the benefit of kind of the knowledge that we've earned that we've learned over the years. So, you know, one of the things that we talk about in the office is you get the city you deserve, and what we mean by that is that if you don't continue to invest in a city from, you know, and that can be invest in its culture, in its music, in its food scene, in its art scene, but also at the same time looking after the most disadvantaged in that city. Because I think that gives an external perception to investors, to tourists, and you know, just to the population of a city region as a whole. So we got interested in doing things around homelessness initiatives. So one of the first things that we did was we bought a former tour bus of a rock band, and
which band?
A few bands actually, because it acted for a few bands, but. I can't think of anyone. Any that are, I think Eric Clapton used it, and also Tiny Temper. So there's a bit of a bit of variety there.
Paint a picture of the bus.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool. Big leather seated areas, and Sky TV, and Xboxes, and all kinds. And we've converted that into a kind of, if you like, a mobile homeless bus, which provides 5,000 nights a year off the streets. And so that fascinates me, using creativity and innovation to come up with to solve old problems. You know, there's been rough sleeping and homelessness in these cities for as long as we can remember, all of us. But there are definitely some interesting new ways of solving those challenges. And then, in turn, I think that it's quite addictive once you get involved, and
it's taking up a lot of your time, isn't it?
Yeah, more than I anticipated it might do. Maybe certainly 2 or 3 days a week now are involved in things, extracurricular activities, I call them, outside of property. You know, regeneration brain is one of them as well. But there are a lot of lessons that you learn from these things as well. There's a lot that you can apply back to property and real estate and development and the built environment. So, it's not all out of the goodness of my heart. You know, there are definitely advantages, and definitely loads of knowledge that you can gather from it. And so Regeneration Brainery is a great example of that. You know, the stuff that we pick up from that is vast, and that definitely helps us to grow as a business. We spend £2 million a week on regeneration, and that's grown significantly over the past 2 or 3 years, because 2 or 3 years ago it might have been £1 million a week. So and I think that's that people bit, understanding people, and actually having a mission statement based around social positive, having a positive social impact, that definitely resonates with investors and with our consumers that want to buy things and rent space offers. And that social impact can be anything from restoration of historic buildings and conservation of those, to creating jobs in areas of worklessness and high levels of deprivation. It can be creating homes for owner occupiers, as you know, we ban investors from buying our homes. So and that's the difference for me between kind of gentrification and regeneration. You know, if the people that are going to be the beneficiaries of it, who are the people who are taking that chance and investing kind of their own time and life and money in that location, then that's regeneration. But if fundamentally, if the beneficiaries are just the money men, then that's just gentrification. And so I think that people are starting to understand that more now, and actually see it as an alternative approach to development.
I remember sharing something in Manchester a couple of years ago, actually, with with Tom Bloxham, and we were talking about whether regeneration was a dirty word at the time, and a lot of the London-based developers and those involved in development felt that it was, and Tom's view was not round here.
No, I think, you know, for us, I don't think, you know, the reason that any town or city or even building falls into a state of kind of dereliction and decay is often because it stops evolving, and so you know, and that's what the process of regeneration is. It's a constant evolution of a building or a town or a city. And so regeneration never stops. I don't think a city ever stops growing, and I think that that's almost that probably something that we've learned as a city in Manchester, that actually the work is never done. It's ongoing, and that there's always ways to improve, and it's that constant improvement that you strive for, really. So I've heard that, you know, that thought that, well, it's not about regeneration now, but actually it could just be semantics. But I think that you got to keep going. You can't give up and sit back and rest on your laurels. And what you need to do actually is ensure that the beneficiaries of regeneration investment are touching the grassroots of a city. Because if you don't, then eventually one day, you know, you could find yourself without a city to sell to. You know, without an occupier, without a resident that wants to be in the city. So that, I think that's why it's really important to make sure that there is a business case, if you like, for investing at grassroots levels and ensuring that that it's the consumer that benefits just as much as the investor.
You mentioned the Brainery and you talked about people, and that's a different way of being inclusive and bringing different people into regeneration. How does it work?
The idea came about from really us getting approaches for work experience. And often the approaches that we'd get for people for work experience would be from other people in the sector, for their kids, you know, to come and get involved. And we thought, well, we're not particularly providing a useful environment for those people to come and hang out with us for a week. They'd listen to us sit in meetings using various three-letter abbreviations and other things that they didn't understand. And then they'd kind of wander off and perhaps not feel particularly inspired to get involved in the in the built environment sector. And then I suppose the other motivation was that they all seem to be from a similar demographic, you know, some from a fairly middle class background. And we were also conscious of a lot of the things that we do are in areas of deprivation that need regeneration. And when you're talking to a community about what you're going to do to their community to make it better, you can almost see them and sometimes you do hear them looking back at you going, you haven't got a bloody clue what we need in our city or in our town. You've never walked in our shoes. And so we were aware that as an industry that by just via kind of that nepotism thing was just potentially just going to proliferate a groupthink and an entire generation of future real estate people who don't necessarily have the right skill set and background and knowledge as to what our future cities need. So to make us more relevant and resilient, we thought we could create a platform whereby we can inspire people from a variety of backgrounds and much more diverse group of backgrounds and perhaps some disadvantaged backgrounds as well, and inspire them rather than educate them to be in the built environment and property sector. And it was an experiment, really. So we just we invited kind of handful of students and young adults to pop along to our space in Manchester and invited some mentors along to say, could you just tell them about your experiences and how you got into property and explain to these young adults what you like about it, what you hate about it, and what your route was to work in it. And that went really well, so we ran it again later that year, and then we got some more mentors involved, and we've got some really big hitters involved in giving up their time.
Blue chip partners.
Yeah, we've got some great partners. We've got Lambert Smith Hampton, DLA the law firm, and Homes England as well, massive supporters of it. And big mentors as well, you know, big hitter individuals who spare their time, give up their time to come and talk to these young adults, but I think find it quite a rewarding exercise. So we think that and they tell us that they get as much out of it as they do put into it, which is great. And now we've grown, so accidentally we're kind of working with over 100 young adults every year now, and there's a new cohort of those, and we've expanded from Manchester into Birmingham and Bristol and London. We're in Sheffield next week. We open in Sheffield next week. So that's not us. It's the industry. That's what's really nice about it. That's not Kaplan-centric. It's not just Lambert Smith Hampton or DLA or Homes England. It's just the industry collectively with all the different mentors generously giving their time. All we've done is just create a platform for it to happen. We create the infrastructure around it. It's really nice to see the support that the industry's given it and elevated it to a level that I'm absolutely gobsmacked. It's been 3 or 4 years. It's grown beyond all comprehension, which is incredible to see.
You and I have been having these conversations on stage and off for quite a few years now, but it seems to me, and I've talked about it on the podcast before, how that narrative is changing in real estate, from talk of yields and all the sectors and a focus on geography to conversations that are led by social impact, sustainability, inclusion, well-being, all of those things. If you feel like defining yourself as a pioneer, please go ahead. I fear you might be too modest to do so, but do you think that that change has happened, that it's embedded and it will stick?
I think it has. I think you're right, and I think it is embedded and will stick around, because you've got some massive global organisations that absolutely have made it part of their mission statement. And I think that the difference comes from, it has to be in the wider consciousness of the public, and I think it is. I think that if you think about it, money makes things happen. And if you think about the global funds that invest in that money, they're told by their shareholders and their investors and the man in the street, essentially, that they want their money to be used in an ethical way, in a way that adds to the, that adds something more than just a financial return. They want a financial return as well. So the great thing about that is that that money then needs an outlet that will achieve that for them. Almost all of our funding now, we have no bank debt whatsoever, and we're spending £2 million a week, and almost all that funding comes from organisations that have a requirement to demonstrate a positive social impact with their funds, not exclusively, but largely, and growing all the time. So when you hear these big, well-known pension funds talking about ensuring that their investment has a positive social impact, then that's when it's here to stay, it's here for the long run.
And it's an investable proposition now.
Absolutely, yeah, which is a great thing, that everyone can, that there is a bigger benefit over and just over and above the financial thing. So, I don't feel I don't feel bad or guilty about that at all, or feel as though, all we're doing is helping to further the aims of these funds. I actually think it's a really, really positive thing, and actually we know generationally as well, it's only going to increase. I think in the future you're going to have to demonstrate what it is that you do that does more than just create a financial output.
Where do you think that might head next? Are we reaching, peak ethics?
I think it's tip of the iceberg, to be honest, in many ways. I suppose there's a fascination with people and property. There always has been. And we are in many ways responsible for the built environments. It means that you end up interacting and affecting society in many different ways around, around energy in a big way, around housing, around infrastructure. In many ways, we've got an increasing responsibility, I suppose, to make stuff happen, to make change happen. And as an industry, I think we've been slow to adapt in the past, but actually we hold a lot of the keys. We're kind of the gatekeeper in many ways to making stuff happen and better. I think it'll continue in a huge way, which is a great advantage and a huge opportunity for the industry, really. If we can make car travel cleaner, if we can make our homes and our places of work low energy, so we don't have to burn stuff to switch a light on, we've got the ability, really, and to govern that pace of change, and I think increasingly we're going to find the public looking at us to say, come on guys, we need you to sort it out.
Yeah, real estate doesn't have a positive reputation among the man and woman on the street. Do you think that's deserved?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I think it's probably fair. I think that in the past, we probably suffer from perhaps not our efforts. It's probably the efforts of those that have gone before us that have been a little bit slow to budge. But I think that the pace of change that's occurring at the minute in the industry across lots of different things is rapid, and it's great to see actually the big institutions and the big property companies that are out there leading the charge as well in many ways. It's easy for us because we're a small, nimble organisation. We can change direction and we can crack on, and we don't have much approval. No one's going to sack me, perhaps other than my wife and my kids. But we've got the ability to take advantage and to adapt and improve ourselves. But it's great to see the big organisations, huge organisations, to turn around are making a genuine effort to address things like climate change, energy efficiency, wellness, mental health, and so on. I think as an opportunity, there's a big one for us, and the future's bright.
Glass half full.
Absolutely. I am a property developer, so I have to assume that everything's going to be better tomorrow.
Okay, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks.